Sim, estou, amor. Sim, pois, pois. Que horas? 11? Pois, amor, é que isto aqui está sem trabalho. Pois, sim, eu vou chegar o mais depressa possível. É só despachar aqui isto? Sim, pois. Amor, pois. Até logo.
In the 1960s, a wave of German bands and musicians emerged intent on creating new sounds and exploring new technologies.
As an artist, you have to create something new, your own way. You have to create your own art.
We were pretty much aware that we weren't raised in the Mississippi Delta, or we weren't raised in Liverpool. Our generation had to come up with a counterpoint to that. If you want to come up with a new sound, you want to touch new ground, you have to use new material, or at least change your perspective. Using machines open up another door for this new quality.
So many musicians, so many bands, so many influences, so this just can happen once, I think, yeah. It was the Blütezeit, the blooming, yeah, of German music at its peak.
This film not only explores the various artists of this experimental movement, but also focuses on the group whose music would influence so much of modern electronica, Kraftwerk.
Obviously, the aesthetic investment was into something completely different from what all the other bands were into. All the other bands were into was the most different means, but they were all into experience. And Kraftwerk was not that. It was obviously about distance to music. It was there was something conceptual, there was something humorous, there was irony.
The difference between Kraftwerk and the other bands, and the other bands wished to totally disassociate themselves from the past of the German's history. Kraftwerk were different. They were willing to embrace the past. In so doing, they actually, in the long term, they invented a new kind of aesthetic that people around the world could really relate to by infusing humor and experiment and brilliant understanding of electronic sound. They basically remade German identity and made it something to actually look at.
The Second World War left Germany in ruins. Over 9 million German soldiers and civilians dead, numerous cities destroyed, and the country split into zones occupied by both the Allied and Soviet military. By 1949, the country was divided into a Soviet East and a capitalist West Germany. And where the East was a socialist state, the West adopted a social market economy that by the 1950s would see the country enjoy a steady period of growth. Despite this economic stability, the youth of the country were born into a ruptured world in which their elders were viewed with suspicion and in which a guilt over the very fact of being a German was widespread. And so by the late 1950s, this new generation began to embrace the youth culture of their Allied occupiers.
there was not much. There was, of course, the Hamburg world, which was shaped by which was a vibrant music scene, and one that also would cross over to other arts, but that was based mainly on traveling British and American bands like the Beatles and others famous, but also like regulars were like bands like Ian and the Zodiacs or something like that, who were but then doing things like accompanying poetry readings by very advanced poets. So, but that's right, there were basically no Germans doing anything interesting musically, with the exception of free jazz. Free jazz in Germany, I would go to the legacy of people like Peter Boltzmann, who was involved with the Fluxus movement in the early 60s, and others. There was a free jazz movement in Berlin happening around people like Alexander von Schlippenbach, Sven Arke Johansson, who came from Sweden. And this was, of course, a completely unique musical movement, and it was based by it was based on scenes in German cities. And out of the Berlin free jazz movement, for example, you had certain bands coming out who were close to the later electronic scene, like Sven Arke Johansson had this band Moderne Europäische Dorfmusik, you know, Modern European Village Music, which was kind of a electronic avant-garde rock free jazz mixture. They recorded in the late 60s, I think, two albums, and played at the same regularly.
Thank you. scene, there was an ignition when the Mothers of Invention came to play. That was an interesting concert because, well, all the students, the SDS, went there. The pupils, all the political scene went there. Well, it was about 10,000 people, and I think most of the scene was there, and people had waited for a band like this to come to Berlin. So it was like a swing from the nice Jerry and the Pacemakers and Equals and pop groups from Britain, Great Britain, to well, flower power, hippie thing. And I think these are also the influences which helped the German musicians develop their own style.
But while much of the German musical scene was simply intent on now mimicking a new kind of American music, experimental musicians began to emerge who would shape a unique sound. Konrad Schnitzler, who had studied sculpture under radical German artist Joseph Beuys in Düsseldorf, was central to this new movement. Having relocated to Berlin in the mid-60s, he was a trained artist and not a musician. But he began working with colleagues Hans-Achim Rodelius and Boris Schack on a new form of experimental music that would eventually embrace electronics.
My dream was always to make sounds and music, but I couldn't because I was a musician and never learned. And there were, you know, all also before, there all these young people making this kind of hippie music with a drum and flute and all this, and I was hating this. I was never liking melodies because a melody is like a worm in your head. You hear this melody and the whole day it rattles in your head. I didn't want it. You know, I want to have something that goes in and you lost it already. And Boris and Achim, they said, oh, no, not this. I have another idea about making music. Only if you don't can play an instrument, you can make free sounds. And I want to have, let's say, noise sounds composed together in a way what is interesting. You know? Like if the steam hammer goes here and the bird pipes there and a car comes and the airplane goes over, if you are the director of it, then you say, hey, stop, moment, don't come now, you know? Now all together or whatever, you know? This is the only philosophy I want, and the philosophy behind is, as an artist, you have to create something new.
At the real beginning, I just wanted to try what's going on when I use a flute or my voice or drums. How do I react on what I'm doing with any sort of instrument or any sort of noise? So it was not music at all that influenced me, or not any style or not any trend. I just was so curious to work with noise and sounds and tones, to become aware what's that, what's music, what does it, what's the ground in it. How should it be?
And needing a rehearsal performance space, Schnitzler and Rodelius began to rent part of a theater. This room eventually became the Zodiac Free Arts Lab.
We had this room, and we made a lot of Boris and Achim, they bought some new instruments, you know, for cashing later. Because it was all so really fantastic. Yeah, we played there 2-3 days. Nobody came. Of course not. We made no advertising for nothing. Nobody knows us. Nobody know what was going on there. So our group was called Geräusche, means noises, you know. And I had the small, tiny papers and with a stamp. And 100 of these papers we stamped, and we give them as flying papers around, and where was if there was somewhere a concert of modern music, like in the area of the television station, is it now? Yes, Radio SFB, and the people came out and give them the paper, or there was Emerson, Lake and Palmer somewhere playing, we put this papers around, and it was really dark also there, and you saw the papers flying. And so afterwards there was coming people. And then we invite also other musicians, groups, but not normal groups. Sometimes they want somebody plays who just played music from other groups, you know. We didn't want it, we want something what was experimental. And so there came like Schulze with his group came, and of course Edgar came back, and I was with Edgar already in a connection, you know, and he came with his group, and so we had, and it was full of equipment, everything, you know. We didn't remove this. It was forever there, and only the groups who was then on the end in have the right to play there every evening. But means after the theater was to the end, because otherwise it was too loud, you know.
when I think of Kraftwerk and our organization and the whole scene around them, the things that would come to my mind as forerunners would not be in the field of music, but in the field of fine art, visual art. I think the Düsseldorf scene at the 60s was a very vibrant scene based around this place, this club called Cream Cheese, which was very important, which was a nightclub, a discotheque, decorated and organized by people from the Zero Movement, which was a kind of very important movement, and other artists around. The Düsseldorf Art Academy was there, where people like Josef Beuys were teaching at that time. And this is far more, for me, the culturally important background.
Yet although there was a major influence from the world of the visual arts, there was also a more academic element to these bands. Unlike the various artists from the Zodiac scene or those in Amondul, the organizations Florian Schneider and Ralf Hutter and Cannes Holger Schukai and Ermin Schmidt were classically trained musicians. And classical music itself had been going through some radical changes since the 1930s, with various composers striving to introduce an electronic component into it. A major figure in the introduction of new sounds and electronic techniques in this area was Frenchman Pierre Schaeffer.
Pierre Schaeffer was important in France because he had a studio in Radio France. Most of the early electronic studios were in radio stations in the late 1940s, mid-1950s, because they had the equipment. The equipment they were using was basically tone generators, oscillators, sine wave generators, very basic sound equipment that produced, that changed sound waves. And then they didn't have tape. Pierre Schaeffer's early experiments with music were discs from records. What he did was he actually got records, 78s of say train sounds, water sounds, crowd sounds, marching band sounds, and mixed them together and invented this thing called music concrete, or real music.
Bands were beginning to branch out, and the growth of experimental German music started to appear more like a movement than a set of isolated individuals and collectives. Ralf Hutter and Florian Schneider's The Organization recorded their first and only LP, Tone Float. Behind the desk for the album was Connie Plank, a young producer and engineer who had recently completed work with Cluster on their debut, Klopfzeichen, and who had set up his own company, Rainbow Productions, to record new German music. Tone Float was for both the organization and for Plank an experiment, a testing ground for new ideas.
Tone Float is an album that is completely different from, say, what happened with Kraftwerk eventually, mainly because it is more percussive-based. There's a lot of percussion on it. Percussion, flute, and sort of a lot of warbling in a way. If it could be seen as a success, I don't know if it can be seen as a success. I think it's more of an experimentation, really. It's a way of them sort of like finding their own feet, really, in a way, you know, finding what they could do as this band and trying to see where they could take it. At that point, electronics played very little part in their sound. It was mostly acoustical instruments, you know what I mean? So it sounds a bit like a sort of ethnic recording in a way, believe it or not, like a German ethnic recording. But you hear it today, and it is an extraordinary sort of example of early krautrock.
Berg's self-titled debut was issued in late 1970 on the Philips label, only months after the release of Tone Float. With both accessible and highly experimental material contained across its four tracks, it went on to sell 60,000 copies in Germany.
That was solidly based on building rhythms and putting them together in a way that, you know, would become memorable and danceable too, I should imagine. So they were interested in compressing their sound in a way and creating a rhythmic stride to it that would appeal, I should imagine. They were trying to be appealing as well as, you know, revolutionary.
Here we go. I think with each subsequent Kraftwerk album, they are stripping back something, is a little bit more and more, but of course it's still with the stage of Kraftwerk too. They are still using what you might call conventional instruments, but using them as if, almost as if they were electronic instruments in some ways, and they are experimenting with laying down different configurations, different patterns, with repetitions, almost using the instrument as a thing in itself, you know, exploring textures, as it were, rather than text, you know, still reluctant to introduce vocals. And so it is, you know, looking back at the time, I mean, they've disavowed those albums of Kraftwerk. They don't really want people to hear them. They'd rather that the year zero of Kraftwerk occurred a little bit further down the line in the mid-70s somewhere. But you can, you know, these albums are actually eminently listenable as things in their own right, and you can see the direction they're heading in.
To be honest, a lot of the tracks in Kraftwerk 1 and 2 are basically experiments. There's not many on those albums which are that melodic, with the exception of, say, Kling Klang on the second record, which is the defining moment in Kraftwerk's, where they come up with this glacial motoric, so a motoric beat and then the glacial keyboards and flutes over the top, which is their trademark. And this is what happened on Kling Klang. I think they probably came upon that, and this would be the sound that would define them, because obviously they couldn't keep on just doing experiments.
First of all, that the synthesizers, it's synthesizer sounding, that forming the basis. So they're directing it, they're leading it, they're shaping it, and I mean, there are no vocals. You've got instruments like flute just playing a kind of very supplementary role, kind of filling in, adding colour here and there. And in fact, they would use electronics to create that kind of effect later on. They've got these wonderful little very speedy effects going on as well. And in a sense, with that album, particularly that track, they are kind of setting the tone for what they're going to do the rest of their career, that kind of futuristic yet serene, you know, it's the equivalent of the painter like Fernand Léger, with these kind of friendly robots handing out flowers, that, you know, the future, new technology, need not be something that mankind should be at odds with. But the rest of the album doesn't really tie in with that. The rest of the album is more kind of, you know, it's more kind of fragments of experimentation and ideas that they would eventually dispense with.
Brothers was the album of Autobahn. Released in Germany and the UK at the tail end of 1974, it was the last LP that Ralph and Florian would record with producer Connie Plank, and it was the album that catapulted them to the international stage. At its centre was the title track, a 20-minute opus that took up the whole of the record's first time. The duo would eventually dismiss their first three albums, and they chose to reimagine this record as Kraftwerk Year Zero.
The ideal thing was that in Autobahn, it really had a subject matter that combined all the ideas they were thinking of. That was the genius thing about it, all of a sudden they had a subject matter. So far they were these conceptualists were thinking about ideas of how to be an artist or how to be a musician in the pop world with all these visual artists concepts around. But they didn't have a concept matter. They didn't have a subject matter. And then the idea of the German-ness was the next thing, but it was still something that had to be concretized every time in a specific way. And here they had everything together. They had a highly musical subject matter, the road. Then the specific German version of it was this problematic thing, you know, the proverbial achievement of the fascists, no? that it's always this kind of proverbial talk of the German after the Second World War said, yeah, Hitler wasn't so bad after all. I mean, he shouldn't have done this with the Jews, but at least he built the Autobahn. That's this kind of... So Autobahn means this too. And then, of course, it's the musical aesthetic of that. Something that takes from minimalism the unfinishedness of music. Music that has a structure that's not saying there's a climax, at one point we come to an end, but it's possibly endless. All this together was a great moment.